This is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell-West.
And this is the beginnings of summer outside. And
after the hottest April on record, again.
And looking forward to the hottest May on record, again. And probably the hottest June. Never mind. Let me not talk about this. Let me smear on some sun cream. And let's talk about a couple of final questions out of a venerable gaming institution, which is now folding. Questions about introducing people to new systems and about villainy. But first, Roger has the opposite of some villains to introduce. He wants to thank some heroes of our podcast.
Yes, thank you particularly to Robert Wolfe, Dave Morris and Glenn Lewis, all of whom have put some money in our tip jar. This is very helpful. It encourages us to keep doing it. It pays for the occasional half cup of coffee.
I try to spend all of my profits on gaming products.
If you want to contribute, paypal.me/RogerBW.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate it muchly.
Onward!
I was bemoaning last time the ending of the venerable gaming appa. Alarms and Excursions, which has been accompanying the developments of the hobby since the 1970s, and has been a proximate cause of several of them. And every month, Lee Gold, the editor, would put forward a proposed topic of debate called the Ignorable Theme, which dashed about all over the place. I've used some of them for inspiration for parts of this podcast in the past. And I thought, in honour of the passing of an institution, I would ask Roger to join me in looking at the last two topics which were proposed before the magazine came to an abrupt end.
If it turns out to get resurrected in a new form, well, shrug.
We will mention this if it does. There are murmurings in the background about how to do it without having Lee to lean on, as we have for so many years. Right, Ignorable Theme number 594 for May, deadline April the 21st. Introducing players to a new rules system, especially to new combat rules. And I find this a piercing and apposite question just at the moment, because having become discontented with GURPS Monster Hunters game I was running, and one of the players having become discontented with the Dungeon Fantasy game, which was introduced as a substitute whilst we had people going away on holidays, I am now thinking again that maybe if I'm going to run something other than RuneQuest and GURPS ever in the future with this group, I'm going to have to start bringing the more obscure things in. And they have been tried in the past a bit by my tendency to experiment with new systems. But I'm feeling that way, and just at this moment in time, if they want inspiration from me, they may have to accept something they're not used to. So I got out all the piles of stuff that I have thought about running. And I have, of course, being me, run into difficulties which are causing me confusion and confusion. Mostly, this is inspired by Unknown Armies, something I'd really like to run. But there are difficulties. It strikes me, and this applies to all games, there are difficulties at three levels. There is a difficulty of introducing the system and what it does, what it does well and what it demands of the players. Tied in with that, there is the difficulty of finding a background with which to use this particular rules set, which would show it off to its advantage. And then there is the difficulty, which the question alludes to, of getting them practiced with the things that they can do on a, it can do on a small scale. And combat is the most intimate and detailed of systems in most games for a reason. It grabs the heart and makes the blood to pump.
Sometimes physically.
I have not yet seen bloodshed at my gaming table.
Just remembering the early days of GURPS, there was a recommendation very common for that and occasionally for earlier games that you should essentially get your players to stat up some disposable characters and put them into a combat so that they would find out how combat worked.
I think in principle that's not a bad idea, but I would be inclined to spread it out a bit and make up... I would start the campaign with a series of immediate race scenes in which each player gets to do the thing they are most noted for, most built for, and a duel, a non-lethal duel, which tests the combat system and all the fancy stuff like parries and ripostes and deceptive attacks, to use GURPS terms. All the neat things it can do in a single scene would be extremely useful, I would say.
I suspect these days, at the very least, you would want pre-generated characters for that.
Pre-generated characters are a thing that I like as a GM, but my players are sometimes less than respectful of my ability to construct them.
But for the specific purpose of learning a new system. I mean, if one of your players already knows the system, then you can hive off the character generation work on them. But I'm thinking that you're going into unknown armies. You want people to see how... Yeah, the highlights of that system. One way to do it would be, these are not your characters. These people are going to fail horribly, probably, because they're not armies. Here is how you can get used to the mechanics of them doing so.
The sacrificial... the sacrificial demo characters, the people who die before the opening credits roll. That's a neat thing. I feel a strong temptation whenever I think about it of not telling them that these are sacrificial characters. And then sacrificing them anyway.
I still have a notion of a horror scenario in which you are the expendable meat, and in the first half hour you will get horribly murdered by the monster, and then the investigators turn up. But that's a separate thing.
Okay, something
does link into this. A term that used to be bandied about a lot and is rather less now, but I think is worth considering, is system mastery. In other words, the idea that the players should be not just familiar with, but actively competent at the system. And this is a thing that is very much what you expect in something like a D&D or Pathfinder game. Players are expected to choose their character upgrades and choose the right ones so that their characters are maximising their combat effectiveness and so on.
Yeah.
But that's very much not the way I run games. To cliche it in the other direction, I would say I want you to play your character, not the system. And that is one of the reasons I stick with GURPS a lot more than perhaps I should, because most, not all, of the decisions you are making when playing a GURPS character are either directly or immediate proxies for a decision that the character would make. Am I going to charge in and make sure I get that hit on the guy no matter what, or am I going to fight more defensively? That kind of thing. This has an obvious real-world analogue. So, on the one hand, I don't want to have to teach the system. I want people to say, don't worry about your pluses, just tell me what you're doing. On the other hand, it's really nice when the players remember after the third or fourth session that what you do is roll against the skill I just asked you to roll and tell me how much lower you get on 3d6 than that skill number. Thank you.
I do have one player who we do have to remind. This time it's D100s. Last time it was 3d6. And the other way around. I found, looking at Unknown Armies, a difficulty which I'm not sure if it's... I think it is a growing feature of modern game settings, in which two things, the setting itself and the group in which the players are formed, also have to be made up. And this means that it gives me a slight difficulty with Unknown Armies, because there's a lot of lore, there's a lot of background, and there are a lot of ideas which aren't familiar to the average gamer. Even the average horror gamer may find some of them difficult. And I don't see how you can make meaningful choices about who your characters are and what your group is like, what your group's aims and desires and what holds them together is like, without a huge chunk of world lore, of setting lore, and that is going to be a bit of a difficulty. Ideally, what I want is something like you're washed ashore at this foreign country, and you have to discover them, and you're a group of people from a totally different culture, which was the opening of Empire of the Petal Throne, which is still, you know, a classic.
Well, I have seen the starter kits. The one I've played was Raiders of the Lost Mart. I don't know whether these were Kickstarter extras or something else, but I've certainly seen them floating about, and I think they are available. And what you get there is not just a setting, but also a set of characters. I mean, on the one hand, as you say, you know, some people very much want to generate their own characters. On the other hand, this is you have at least approximate relationships with the other people. In this case, you are the night shift on the supermarket,
And things keep turning up on the shelves.
Yeah,
shudder.
But that certainly makes it much easier to get the hang of things, because you don't need to know all the deep lore of the setting. And you can learn it in the course of play, and hope you learn it fast enough before something eats you.
Yeah, I would say that Unknown Armies and a number of other games I've read offer a promise of being able to do just about anything within the assumptions of the game for anybody, but it doesn't provide an easy way into the setting, an easy way of discovering the setting, and that isn't a pre-genned subset of the setting, a pre-genned campaign. And I find that a little annoying. I was thinking, and by the time next week comes, I may have decided on something else entirely, that I didn't like the D sanction. But the historical version of Unknown Armies might fit it. The basic idea that you are working for Elizabeth's court as counter supernatural officers, and you're there because you have been guilty of some piece of monstrosity or witchcraftery, and are already condemned to death. I was thinking that might be a very Unknown Armies sort of game. And I might be able to do something with it. But it feels like if I impose that on the players, they need to give meaningful consent to what I'm proposing to saddle them with for some months, if not forever.
And I think this is especially true with horror games.
Yeah, quite. There is a subset of horror games which is Call of Cthulhu, which has a certain group of cheerful assumptions built into most of the gamers I know, which says you're going to die. Try to have fun whilst doing it.
The heroic attitude to this, I think, is I will give my life, my health, my sanity in order to save the world, and I will be happy to do that.
Yeah, but Call of Cthulhu says you're going to try and you might have a temporary success, but doom waits for you.
I'm not the only person who needs to do this to save the world, sure.
Now, that's not it. That's not the message in the true Cthulhoid thing. It is, the world is doomed. Your human efforts to save the world are doomed and will at best give a few more decades of life to the universe.
But that's worth it.
Arguably, yes, but it's not something you can do with a song on your lips, at least I couldn't.
Now, being fair, there are some adventures, particularly the ones tagged as traditionalist adventures for Gumshoe, Clan of Cthulhu, which I'm not going to name titles here, but explicitly you cannot win. The world is going to end during the course of the scenario. You are going to watch it do so. And that is not a sort of game that I'm interested in playing, but that's fair enough. The people I know who run games aren't interested in running it either.
Yeah, I find that... Anyway, the problem is... the problem is the gap between what you tell the players at the start and the surprises you have to have if you're going to run the game. This is drifting away from the given topic, but we always do, and we always did in Alarms and Excursions. But it is writing the introduction without being dishonest, but without revealing everything as well. I think I'm just going to have to ask them to trust me to not be a monster.
These people have been playing with you for a while. Presumably, they have some idea of the sort of thing that you consider acceptable to put in a game by now.
Yeah, and I have a long collection of the times they've kvetched at me about the things I have put in a game. All right, so let's assume we've got beyond that step. We've convinced them that this is a setting, and that they can come to an agreement about what sort of group they are in.
Yeah, and as a GURPS player, I do tend to think of setting and system as quite separate things.
Well...
I know that many of them are tied in. Well, that's the thing I wanted to come on to. I wrote a blog post about this recently. The term crunch in the description of a game is traditionally used to mean lots of real-world numbers. So GURPS will say... You know, if you get shot with this particular sort of handgun while you're wearing that particular sort of armour, it's going to hurt approximately this much, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, sometimes this has little room for heroism. You get shot by a bazooka while you're wearing a string vest. I don't care how amazingly tough you are as a normal person, you are not going to survive that.
If you do it with style, we may give bonus points to your next character.
But there is a separate thing, which is the thing is the GURPS one you can reality check. Mm. Some of it may be impractical, but you can, how far can a healthy person march in a day and how useful are they at the end of it, that kind of thing. But there is also what I think of as abstracted crunch. I've been listening to the Esoteric Order of Role Players play of the One Ring recently, and they have things like, I spend a point of hope to get a bonus on this die roll, and when my hope goes below my something else value, I am disheartened and I get penalties on all my rolls, that kind of thing. And then I find it very hard to attach that to a decision the character is making. But also you can't reality check it. You can't say how hopeful is Bob when he tries to jump this chasm. And I, to me, that is just as much crunch, but it's harder to relate to because I can't visualise. You know, there is no direct process that is being modelled here. There is just it lives entirely within the rules.
Yeah, the Unknown Armies is heavy on psychological crunch. It wouldn't be the game it is if it didn't. The number of unpleasant things that have happened to you changes your personality slowly as you stress out, and there's a limit to the amount you can come back from that, and it affects not only your psychological state, but it affects some of the skills. Your ability to relate to people may go down, and your ability to lie to them will conversely go up.
Mm.
And it's a subtle sort of a system because the light side abilities are also what you use to resist the psychological impact, and your ability to resist is going to go down as those light side abilities go down. It's interesting.
I think it's a big improvement over the traditional Call of Cthulhu, you know, when you lose enough sanity, you're useless. Because apart from anything else, it's not explicitly bad. It is bad for the character in some ways, but it is good for them in other ways.
It degrades them as a human being, whilst it might make them tougher in facing the things that they have to face. But if you get too degraded as a human being, you stop being able to access the really neat abilities that come with them. Being human is part of doing magic and manipulating the universe, and you have to preserve that, which is a very nice touch on the game. I tell me, do you find the power characteristic in RuneQuest to be one of the things that you can't imagine? It's a simple measure of how much of a certain type of...
In RuneQuest, it's fine. In Call of Cthulhu, it's a bit rougher for me because it gets used as a proxy for your starting sanity. It gets used as... not just do you resist the magic, but also, to some extent, do you resist the very persuasive guy? Sort of thing.
I think there are points of games that become so abstracted that you can't you can't get any sort of hold upon them. I think psychological changes are good from an internal identifying with the character point of view and a chance to choose scenery and do some emoting from the role-playing and immersion point of view. But when you get things like, well, in my memory, Exalted the Fair Folk is the worst offender, but I'm willing to put forward Invisible Sun as something I could grok in the bloody slightest. It's an absurdist setting with an absurdist system in which you are playing people who used to be magicians trapped in an earthly incarnation and are now just coming back to being magicians again, and you can't understand a single sodomizing thing that the setting is handing you. You can't understand the effects you make. You can't understand the sacrifices you make to get better effects. It's all absurd levels of setting mastery and system mastery. And I can't grok it at all. And I think you need something that people can relate to, even if they're superheroes, even if they are selling their soul to the devil. You need something that they can grasp hold of and make that character and that experience real. But that is a rant for another day, maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're of a mind with Stan Lee there, who, you know, Spider-Man, X-Men... The idea that the superheroes should have relatable problems as well as superhero problems.
Yeah. It isn't just about them being teenagers, but any more than Buffy is just about being a teenager and the stresses of going to school. But it's about that as well.
So a couple of system points that came to mind for me were the more specific the game gets, the more I expect the players to do. Again, not because I necessarily want them to be thinking in rules terms, but if you're playing, say, a GURPS superhero,
yeah,
your powers are going to have different ranges. And it's probably a good idea if you're aware of that and bear it vaguely in mind when you decide, oh, I'm going to energy blast that guy on the building over there. Yeah. How far away is he? He's across the street. You don't have that range. But you do have that range on your mind control. This is the thing that, you know, the character can reasonably think about, but a player doesn't necessarily expect, because it's not exactly in the superhero mindset.
You do want your players to be an expert in their own character, in what makes their own character workable. And I have had criticisms from players when I let them have things, and I didn't really understand what I was allowing them to have. And I can't handle it as player. I have to say, if it's there on the character sheet, if it's there in the rules, I have to say, yeah, you can do that, and then practically scramble around for a means to control that character and stop him from dominating.
The entire universe, you say?
Yeah. Cosmic, no, yeah, I should say, no, you can't have that level of cosmic power, or no, that level of cosmic does not give you that level of power more often.
The other example that came to me, and we did in the original brief have the mention of combat, Traveller. Which you, specifically, we're talking here about the relatively new Mongoose Traveller, which you have run and I am currently running.
Yeah.
And that definitely needs people to know what their options are. I think it is harder than GURPS in that respect, because, as I say, in GURPS you can say, I'm being very committed about this attack and I don't really care who else might hit me as I'm doing it. But, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. But it's got this major minor action system. And if you are used to a system in which you basically say, OK, it's your turn, what do you do? Then that can be quite tricky, because you can, for example, almost every time, if you're in sustained firefight, you are probably doing minor action aim, major action fire every turn, and you're getting that plus one every turn. If it's the first round of it, then you might do minor action ready weapon, major action fire. So, you don't have to take a turn to do it. This isn't the one-second GURPS combat turn, but you aren't going to get your own bonus. Or you could say, right, I'm going to trade my major action for two minor ones, which is one of the standard things. And you can say, okay, this round I'm going to aim. Next round I'm going to aim, fire, and I get a plus four. None of these is a hard thing, but they are things that you have to have in your head that, rather than say, I'm going to take my time and take a really good shot the way people do in GURPS, you have to be able to say, okay, the way this works in terms of the specific action mechanics is.
I think with something like that, something that isn't immediately obvious in the way it works. On the other hand, GURPS isn't immediately obvious. I'd say that running a small scale combat with multiple player characters would be the way to go with that, rather than with a one-on-one person duel, which is what I would tend to recommend with something like GURPS.
And if you've got players who are prepared to read stuff, then just running this perhaps on one's own or with a friend and then writing it up, die roll by die roll, mechanic by mechanic might be helpful too.
Yeah, the descriptions you get in rule sets are not always including the things that you need to learn, or not all of them, and it would increase the length of books immensely.
Yeah.
There have been markets for system mastery books in the past, and there is a How to Be a GURPS GM books, but there isn't How to Be a GURPS Player as such.
Well, there sort of was. I do not know what the licensing deal was, but there was actually a GURPS for Dummies that came out. It was not written by any of the regular GURPS authors. And it is basically, from what I've seen of it, it is basically how to power game GURPS.
Mm.
I do not know why this book exists. I do not know why it was authorised. Shrug, business, etc. But you probably haven't heard of it, and there's a reason for that.
No, I have heard of it, and there is a copy of it on my shelf, long unconsulted. I think I got the impression it was somebody who had done a GURPS, a fantasy campaign with GURPS, and wanted to tell the world about it. And GURPS can be bent in many different directions. And I think that's probably true of any really detailed and complex system.
I would recommend, in fact, the How to Be a GURPS GM book, even to books now, even to players. They are mostly aimed at the GM, yes. But there are things like Sean Punch's notes on, okay, these are the skills that at least one person in the party really needs to have in almost any setting. Here are the skills that everybody in the party should be at least not completely incompetent in. That kind of thing.
Hmm. I think on the whole, I'm going to say that if you're introducing a system to people for the first time or after a long disuse or with a new version, then you should probably plump in front of them a here's where I want to use this, a campaign frame at the very least, and then let them if they can design the player character group if it's important.
Well, we're diverging a little more, but I think this comes into how do you decide what. How does the group decide what is the next game that's going to be played? And I think my experience is generally one or more GMs each produce one or more campaigns that they would be happy to run, which will typically say both a system and a setting, even when those aren't tightly bound. So I might say, you know, GURPS Fantasy in the Islands off Arater, on Bandstorm. And you know, a paragraph or so of right, well, you're going to be pirates, eliding the nasty bits of piracy because you are heroic pirates with teeth that go ting, that kind of thing. So to my mind, the choice element of that has been done before the game gets actually started, though I am increasingly actively preferring not just putting up with having a session zero, which is not, I mean, session zero has now come to mean the bit where you negotiate.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about eye injury because of player X who is squicked by eye injury, which is fine. That needs to be done. But session zero to me is also, I like, even now that I'm playing mostly online, perhaps especially, to get the character generation done as a group. Partly so that the players can say, okay, you know, we've only got one person with first aid, maybe I should take some as well. But also partly so they can talk about, okay, this is the sort of thing that X has done before the campaign started. Is that a thing in the setting, they can say? And I can say, yes, you might have been over here at this time when that was happening.
Hmm.
And it is the interactive building of a background. Especially with something like Traveller, where you've got this career system.
Yeah, and you can build the characters into each other's backstory.
Yeah, I mean, Morbius Traveller makes this explicit, but it was always a thing that was okay. So why are you particular people hanging around together? And the answer may well be, well, I know him from that time when, and he knows her from that other time, and when we heard about this particular thing, we thought, I need some like-minded nutters to join me on this project.
Okay. I think we've thrashed this... We've thrashed this thoroughly with some useful tips to the newcomer. I don't think I've got anything left to say on this particular topic, but let's move on to the second... Ignorable theme, number 595 and last. June deadline, May 21st. Do you stat and equip your intelligent and powerful villains who are going to defeat the inferior, quote, heroes? Why or why not? Does doing or not doing this influence how you run the session stroke campaign? All right.
Well, I think the answer to the last question is how can it not? But
yeah,
let's get there the long way.
Okay, I'm going to say this as clearly as I can. I tend not to stat out villains until I know I'm going to need them. And I tend to have layers of villains ready as we move towards the final villain. And the early villains may defeat the heroes, but I try to make sure they've got a good reason not to kill them. And the final villain should fight the heroes to a standstill and then lose. That's what I'm aiming for, but the dice may tell me something different.
I think it may be... when I was preparing for this, I realised that I very rarely do this, but I think it is because my games are not generally about, narratively about, the direct confrontation. The climactic moment is much more... the scheme has been foiled, than I will punch the villain on the jaw.
I ran the Dracula dossier, the climax of which had to be them facing down Dracula, and twice, because he respawned, and they had to go to the spawning point. And I did not bother to stat out Dracula until they had fought their way through a number of his minions and a couple of other vampire conspiracies with other lesser bosses.
And so, some of that is harking back a little to the GM learning the system. Presumably some of it is you want to know what's going to be an interesting combat challenge, and at the start of the campaign you can't really say that.
Yeah, and they may. It's a very fine line to draw, designing an enemy who you want to be too much for the players to handle, but who won't just wipe the floor with them.
This is. Really outside my... I'm not doing sufficiently procedural games that this is a thing, because if there is a confrontation, it is very likely to be at a time and in a place I did not expect, with a person with whom I did not expect to get a confrontation.
That's true too. Such things arise when the players have either misunderstood what you're saying or have taken a tactical... turn, which strikes you as being barking bloody mad. the players have misunderstood how dangerous this is supposed to be, and you've decided, well, I did warn them, and decide to let them have it good and hard. This is... And yet, in the early stages of that of the what turned into the Dracula dossier campaign, they were encountering vampires for the first time, and discovering sometimes that they were much harder than that they could defeat, except by a well organized joint effort, and sometimes discovering that they were surprisingly weak and puny. But then there are weak and puny minions at the bottom of the vampiric food pyramid, and it's very hard
remembering playing Fury of Dracula with you, and finally we're on Dracula's trail. Oh look, here is a very minor minion, and we've just used all our expendable resources to stay alive fighting him. How are we supposed to fight Dracula?
Gather resources and have what's the rich character? called?
Lord Godalming.
Have Lord Godalming go shopping, I think is the canonical reply to that. I find, yeah, that is that system, that board game system, is very good at that. I've played Dracula a couple of times, and I never felt not threatened, not in difficulties.
Mm.
Even if I won, I'm always trying to create traps for the players and trying not to gloat when they're going in entirely the wrong direction, which is the harder point, I think. But it's not like that in a role-playing game. You want to very gradually and interestingly and dangerously bring the players and their opposition together. I'm not sure there is a meaningful way to defeat Dracula by boardroom manipulation, even though he is deeply embedded in much of the business and the politics of that setting.
In HeroQuest, presumably you could, because you can do anything with anything.
Well, yeah, no. You can only use an appropriate skill to gain an appropriate effect, and we must call it quest worlds nowadays. We really must. But in Dracula, there are separate systems for finding out where Dracula is, finding out who Dracula controls, and finally killing the bastard. And require different sets of skills and different mechanics. And in the end, whilst he is still unalive or still undead, then he is a menace and will come back, no matter how much you struggle and how much you sacrifice. So that game is set up so that there will be a final climactic conflict for good or for ill.
Ralphos, high explosive incendiary round made from fragments of the True Cross from 3 miles. Hell of a shot.
No. I'm pretty damn sure that you need to get up close to Dracula to be able to blow him up with fragments of the True Cross. Otherwise, he'll dodge. and there should be a realistic concern that he's going to turn members of the team or offer the entire team a high rank in his organization and immortality at some point.
You have impressed me, mortals.
We are not so different, you and I.
Yeah, that's the one.
Thinking about it, if it's a matter of a lot of the games I run, there is a nefarious plan ongoing.
Yeah.
And in theory, one could make the villain skill rolls to make progress on that. Whether that is leadership to get his minions to do the right thing, or mad science to advance the design of the device or whatever. In practice, I don't think it makes a difference in play if I do what I actually do, which is one of two things. One is, this is the timetable, which is going to happen if the PCs don't interfere, which is perhaps informed by their skill levels, but I'm not making die rolls as I go along. And the other one, of course, is, well, the plan will be complete 3 minutes after you burst into the lair.
I think there is a mechanic in Blades in the Dark, which is the clock, and the GM starts clocks, and the players start clocks on long-term projects of theirs, and when the players succeed at things, their clocks advance, which may include finding out where the lair is, and over time, and when the players screw up, the villain's clocks advance. They're going to advance to a degree anyway.
We didn't call those clocks in my day; we called them progress bars or check boxes. But whatever.
Yeah. Conceptually, they are, but the user clock design, and similar things have to happen in Greg Stolze's Unknown Armies and Rain, where there are vast opposing conspiracies, and you're only in control of what you're trying to do And they, you have to do something to decide. If memory serves, he does favour the other side making dice rolls. But I could see an argument for just abstracting it out and saying they're doing this unless you find a way to stop them, unless you delay the delivery in Bucharest, that's going to step forward. And if you delay the delivery in Bucharest, somebody will come looking for you.
I'm sure half our audience, both of them, is going to be screaming at this, but what about a Gantt chart or some sort of task dependency graph?
Well, I do not have any qualifications in project management. I only know
that's already what you're doing, and here is a tool that will potentially make it easier. I'm not saying a full-on project management software package or anything like that, but just, you know, as an extension of the clock idea, this thing is happening. When this thing gets to here, it can start, that other thing can start. When it gets complete, this other thing can start, and then there is a tree that leads down to the ultimate victory of evil.
Okay, let me explain a thing that I was going to bring up anyway, which is that I am not going to want to commit myself to what the evil people are actually up to until as late as possible.
Mm.
The players will discover things. I will have to improvise things about the universe, which I didn't know at the start. The players will tell me things about the universe that I did not know at the start. And I have to incorporate them later. I normally have a vague idea about where everything is going, but I don't make what is really going on final until some way into a long-term project.
Oh, that's fair, yeah.
I have. If I do this de-sanction Unknown Armies crossover thing, I have a certain idea about what may really be going on and what they would have to do to frustrate it. But I could change that a turn on a farthing and change that to something else at any moment. That the default, what I think is going on at the beginning, is there at the beginning, but it may not be there at the end. I can't now recall whether Dracula's final plot that they discovered was what I went in with. I sort of think it was, but there was certainly a lot of elaboration added to what was going on. And therefore, as long as I'm consistent, I can be held to be fair.
I think that's a very important thing, not only to do, but to be perceived as doing. Mm. If you're going to let them shoot at the villain, then don't just fudge the role and say, "Oh, he evaded." You say, "Okay, there is an actual in-world reason why you are not able to shoot him."
Yeah, a lot of my villains have teleport devices and the ability to survive jumping off towers, because you should really do that.
As long as an onlooker completes the incantation by saying, "No one could possibly have survived that."
Yeah, all right, that's true too. I think this question assumes things about villainy that I'm not entirely sure are true. Powerful villains are going to defeat the inferior heroes. First of all, the heroes shouldn't be in quotation marks, which is in the question. They may be heroes if they, even if they're too puny to actually do any heroism. And in Call of Cthulhu, that's always the case. In Call of the
Heroism can be tiny.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It's still satisfying to play.
Yeah. I in Call of Cthulhu, the difficulty is finding any creature which isn't going to kill one or more of the players.
Cultists.
Cultists. Even cultists come in numbers, which is which is their defense. They keep coming in a wave of fanatical fearlessness and wielding inappropriate and crude weapons. But they can still kill you with the inappropriate and crude weapons.
I'm just reminded of the game Cthulhu Dark, which is a very lightweight game for which the combat rule is if you fight a mythos creature, you die.
Saves time. Presumably the flavour text on the creature says, and this are the numerous ways in which they can make you die.
Presumably. I haven't played it, but yeah, there's no secrecy here. The players are well aware up front that that's the situation, so...
So, how do they frustrate the evil if they do?
Don't confront them directly.
Send somebody else in with a bazooka?
As I say, I haven't played it, but I think the general idea is try to be subtle, try to undermine them from indirect ways rather than just going down and taking them on hand to tentacle.
I think if you can't throw a dynamite in a Shoggoth's face, life is not worth living. I mean, it's not a good idea to throw dynamite in a Shoggoth's face. It just spreads them about. I would recommend delivery of liquid nitrogen to being the preferred method of dealing with Shoggoths. Pro tip.
One side note. One sort of NPC that I do absolutely stat up very, very firmly and fully indeed, is the NPC who is potentially going to be along with the party for something.
Yes.
For example, she hasn't come into play yet, but in the 2300 campaign that we're playing, the captain of the ship on which you are all crew, or scientists, I have a full set of stats for her because I may suddenly need to say, right, well, here is a situation in which the captain needs to roll space tactics. And I know what her bonuses are.
Yeah, there's also a case for saying, I travelled with the circus when I was young, and I know how to juggle.
I have a system design that's largely based on that, for TV action games, where you basically your backstory starts as a blank, and then you can add stuff to it. Either long term or for an individual episode, and then it can be forgotten about thereafter.
I think that last provision is going to cause people to write into points of view, or if that doesn't exist any longer, but is going to write into your web page. Excuse me, sir, but I remember back in episode 49.
Is that not part of the TV action show experience?
Being disappointed. Oh, hell yes.
I'll just mention in passing, there's one thing I do in GURPS, which it occurs to me I really ought to write up for the Path of Cunning. The micro character. I may have mentioned this before. Yeah. This guy is a guard. He's reasonably competent at being a guard. Okay, his number in the things that he needs to be good at is 12.
Uh-huh.
That's his weapon skill. That's his dexterity. That's his hit points.
That's his perception?
Quite possibly. His number in the things he's not so good at, like resisting blandishment, is maybe a 10.
Yeah.
But, you know, even if the PCs are going to get into a fight with him, that's more or less all I need. And then if the fight does start, I can spin up secondary numbers like damage easily enough from there. But it's a lot less work than a full GURPS, even an animal write-up. But yeah, and the animal write-up is usually pre-done for you anyway by the bestiary. But it's certainly much less work than designing a character who, frankly, isn't going to be all that relevant in detail. And if he ever is, well, yeah, I can spin him up into a full-size character.
I think you need a number for their armour, their... dodge and
armor is what is have about you. 2 or 3 points, yeah.
And
dodge is half number plus 3, same as any other defense.
When you're giving him a 10 to resist psychological manipulation, then you're not going to really want to give him any weaknesses. He's generically weak to that approach.
What does go along with this, of course, is that there is a personality first.
I'm terribly sorry, but my guards are usually... I remember being a security guard myself, and I was either A, talkative, because I hadn't seen anybody for 12 hours, or B, inclined to say, I'm terribly sorry, sir, I cannot do that for you.
Yeah, and this is, that's the thing. It doesn't need to be a big, complex, fully developed personality. But there is a personality. This is the guy who's a bit bored. He's a bit of a shirker. As you say, you know, he's had nothing to do since he came on shift except hassle some small children who are trying to get through the city gate. If you look weak, he will try to bully you. If you look strong, he will knuckle under to you. Whatever. It doesn't need to be a complex thing, but that to me is much more important to the player's experience of interacting with the guy than what his numbers are.
Yeah. Numbers really only come up when you attempt something aggressive and especially combat. But he should be a plausible person to do the job, the job is.
But that's why, you know, job skills are this number. This guy's very good at what he does. He's a 14.
So, yeah, the guy who runs the forensic lab should be 15 in his professional skills and have a little more personality, because you're probably going to come back to him. But the guard on the gate, no. In a comic book or in a short story, you can give him a tragic family life and a child who he isn't going to see, because the players are going to cut his throat. But in this, no, he's just a mook, a figure in the background. It's really very sad, all things considered.
Well, that's tragedy the there. I don't need to write it out in full, but I at least want to have those hooks so that if the interaction gets more complex and interesting, I'm ready to spread that out and say, right, well, here is the actual guy. And if the players just want to say, okay, here's our three silvers, buy your girlfriend something nice, and he accepts the bribe and he lets them through, well, that's fine. We don't need anything more than that.
Yeah, I think you roll the bribe, their bribery skill in secret, and if they fail, he gets all umphy, and if they fumble, he takes the money and sicks somebody on them to follow them and see what they're doing. Yeah. All right.
But I think it's a combination of A, not wanting to do the work unless I have to, because I am lazy, no. And B, being more interested in the people than in the numbers.
It's an admirable attitude. And I think it ties in with my decision to... Don't stat out the villains until they absolutely have to be statted out. This may find you suddenly having to create a vampire character in a hurry, which you really don't want to do under any system I've ever seen. But it will save you time, and the players' fears and the reputation that they gather and the small horrors that they encounter along the way will build that character up in the players' minds and will make the final confrontation all the more worthwhile.
Yep, I certainly say that's fair.
Okay, I think we have come to an end of that, and let me hope that there will be a resurrection, a flowering of a phoenix flame in some other place for Alarms and Excursions. But for now on, you're probably going to hear me talk about it a whole lot less. If you want to tell us about the things you used to have in your role-playing system, which are gone forever and it makes you feel sad, well, we will listen. So you can send it to...
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekedi.ly.
And we will be back again later in the summer, which looks like it's going to be blazing.
Yeah.
He hides in a hole in the ground when the sun is shining.